Hello, I'm Bruce Selry. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Planning for your financial future can be hard if you can't actually see the future, and really no one can. But there are some ways that you can be prepared, in particular prepared for unexpected emergencies. Alyssa Davies takes us through her book, Financial First Aid, Essential Tools for Confident, Secure Money Management. And surprise, one of those financial emergencies could be an unexpected pregnancy. There are many financial considerations to make before a baby comes, and of course, after. Kurt Rosentreter is a CPA and senior financial advisor with Manulife Securities. He's here to take us through new baby finance tips. Then how to be financially prepared if you're walking the path through a divorce. Kelly Lavallee is a CPA, certified divorce financial analyst, and her new book is called Untying the Knot, Protecting Your Emotional and Financial Health During Divorce. And whether it's a retirement plan or a plan to get rid of debt, one approach is segmenting your financial planning into buckets. Financial expert and planner Stephen Brar will be here to talk about how that strategy works. Plus, RateHub.ca's top recommended travel reward cards. Natasha McMillan is RateHub.ca's director of everyday banking. She's the resident credit card expert. She's here to talk about how to earn the most points and spend them in the most efficient way. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. We talk a lot about saving for retirement. We talk less about saving for a new baby, and boy, those babies can be expensive. Today, we're going to look at some of the financial considerations to think about before a baby arrives, and then the follow-on of the next, let's call it 20, maybe 30 years of your life. Kurt Rosentreter is a CPA, portfolio manager with Manulife Securities, and father of two. How old are your kids?
18 and 21.
Oh my gosh. So you have the perspective as a parent who has walked this path directly, but this must be a conversation you have with clients all the time.
Every day, once a week, once a day, I'm in some kind of conversation about kids and financial planning.
I can imagine. Okay. So where in those conversations, where do you start?
Before they have kids.
They haven't had the kid yet. We're starting there.
Then you say to them, there's three dimensions to baby planning you need to get your mind around. One is, do I need life insurance? Because I'm now going to be responsible for other people. Two, should I get a will done now that I'm responsible for another person? And three, the whole financial cost of having a kid from the moment they're born to growing up to age 18 to post-secondary, the whole financial timeline and the cost of that. But three major planning points related to having kids.
How do you frame the cost? I mean, at this point, it's too late. You can see they're coming in. They're having a baby sometime in the next couple of months. It's too late. It's not a financial decision anyway, but it's too late. But what's the number in your head? Hundreds of thousands of dollars, sure.
I'll tell you how I look. It's interesting, Congress. Listen to this. So I've got lots of clients that never have children, and I have very similar people with similar lifestyles that have had kids. You know, looking at where they get later in life, just in terms of accumulating financial wealth, I would say it's $1 million difference.
Wow. Yeah. That's significant. I think my kid's worth $1 million.
When you add up the cost of summer camp, long-term savings for university, if they do that through RESPs, you know, how much meat your son eats out of the fridge, all of the stuff over say 30 years, it can add up to a lot of money. That's a big difference maker, to the point where when I talk about retirement, not what we're talking about today, talk about retirement, I actually coach people on how many kids they should have so not to affect their retirement. Well, that's not good thinking, but I do that.
I hope your kid drinks milk direct from the fridge, from the carton. I want to ask you about the other element on the cost front, because sure, there is a line item and many line items on expenses. There also can be an impact on revenue. And sadly, this is a very much a gendered thing in today's culture. How do you tiptoe into that piece of it?
Well, if someone's going on maternity leave, or paternity leave for the period of time where they're going to be at home with the little one, the new little one. I'll tell you, usually couples or individuals or partners are pretty stressed about the financial shortfall they may face if their employer is not going to top up the paycheck and they're living on EI or sometimes less. And like I've had them in tears, worried about not having enough money, where I've literally said a few things. One is, why do you think this is going to be expensive? Like, you're going to be sitting at home with a little one, and actually the cost of like the first 2 years is among the cheaper end of having kids, because when they get mobile and now you're going to swimming and summer camp and you're going to dance, that's when the real cost starts. So often they're almost wrong on how inexpensive it can be in the first year or two. However, it very much depends on their paycheck and what it's been going towards. As you may know, a lot of people now need two paychecks just to pay their mortgage.
Yeah. An incremental cost, maybe not in the first 6 months, but in the first year on daycare. On daycare, which can
daycare is a doozy. That's right. Right. So you got to look at this in phases. Is that, you know, is your lost income, if there's going to be a lost income while you're on at home raising the little one, is that going to affect your imminent costs that are cost of living, like food, shelter, mortgage, stuff like that? Or is it simply more related to peripheral costs that you'll grow into related to daycare and camps and stuff? And then there's a longer term perspective of, okay, you're going to stay on 5 years of maternity leave. How does that start to affect things like retirement and when you'll be debt free on your house?
How do you help them horse trade? Because I think there would be decisions they would need to make on discretionary spending, when and if they go back to work, whether they have child number two, do they lower the contribution to their retirement plan in those years? That can be a complicated algorithm.
When we start, if I catch them before they've had kids, I try to get them to do some basic budgeting on their cost of living. You know, when you think about it, before you have kids and you got paychecks, life's easy. Lots of money for travel and clothes and fun, right? And the good red wine, maybe. But once you lose that one income and things tighten up, you really got to start with basic budgeting. What do you spend money on in a month or a year? And then once you've got that groundwork, you can start to look at, okay, what needs to go if it's really going to be tight? Or, you know, I'll also say start building up a tax-free savings account before you have the first child. Well, why? Well, that'll give you extra money when you still are generating it for bills and stuff that comes up along the way, like a major car repair that won't otherwise go in a line of credit.
I am evangelical about the RESP. And in fact, I've started making it my baby shower gift. I wait until the child is born and then I sit on the phone and wait there while they open an account and set up the automatic transfer. And then I cut them a check to provide a bit of a boost on that front. Please tell me you are equally passionate about the RESP.
RESP is the cornerstone of whatever your child's going to do post-high school, if it's going to involve any kind of education. Trade school, university, yoga instructor, I don't care. You need an RESP because the government's giving you 20% free money every buck you put in up to a limit. So I'm shocked when I see so many parents around 40 years old with eight-year-old kids that haven't opened one yet. And it's often for the same reason. Not that they didn't know about it, more that I don't have the money for it. And again, I come back to, where's the money going? Did you do a budget? Did you evaluate your cost? Did you explore whether your grandparents can fund it or your parents can fund it? But either way, absolutely, Bruce, cornerstone of where you start. I think a lot of people looking back over 10 years just had the impression that wasn't as broadly available for other non-university purposes. Not so. It's quite broadly available. You could share the money between the kids. And even with the RESP maximized, if they do a four-year major program at an out-of-town university, it probably still won't be enough. So you should go into turning 50 when your kids are age 18. No, you might even have to top it up a bit more beyond their summer jobs.
There are very tough conversations that we as parents need to have either with ourselves or with our spouses and probably with our kids about the trade-offs that need to be made on money for the kid, for orthodontics, for rep hockey, for clothing, for a cell phone, versus the savings that we need to contribute to retirement. And yeah, if you've got buckets of money, that this isn't an issue, but many, if not most Canadians, are living much closer to the line. You're a third party. How do you deliver that tough love?
you know what? This conversation starts around some very sensitive topics, such as do we need to have two incomes in the household if it's a couple, where they can often be at battling on this very decision, where the independent financial planner can come in and really neutralize arguments and say it's mathematical. If you want to achieve more than your children's goals, also your own retirement goals, and often more than that, then yeah, you do need two incomes or not. So you can quantify that and take the steam, the level of stress down by quantifying it. But then when you extend it further into trade-offs between, like you said, rep hockey, extend to summer camps, which can be crazy expensive, if you just cannot do it all, then yeah, sitting down and having a conversation about priorities. I'll tell you something, this is harder. This is a really touchy area, because the number of times I'm in this conversation where the two parents don't agree. And a great example is, well, if you don't have enough money for university, let's say, just using that as an example, because you did put a lot of money into summer camps and $1,500 iPhones. Okay, does that mean you're going to make your children go to school in town to cut the residence costs down? Or does that mean, you're only going to cover the first degree? And you can see clearly they look at each other because they've not heard this line of thinking before. Yet it's totally where they're going to be finding themselves in a few years. So it's powerful. And then one will say, no, we're covering the kids till they're done school. The other one says, no way, my parents only helped me to the end of the first degree. And these are powder keg questions where I would say that they struggle to come to the answers among the two of them. And they either talk into their friends or at least talk into a financial planner that maybe has perspective among hundreds of people like them, will give them a way to diffuse their disagreements and look for rational answers that are often financially based versus emotional.
Do you light incense or blow a referee's whistle when faced with
I don't ever let them get to that point, because I think when you've done a lot of this work and you can talk from a leadership position, they listen. I think that's the key. I'm not selling them anything. I'm talking about goals, the cost of the goals, and the pathway to get there. That's math and income tax often, and how hard they're going to work. That's a lot more straightforward than promising them success by buying a stock or a mutual fund.
Yeah, and then you get the cute little baby who maybe is going to go into the NHL or be a dancer with the National Ballet, and you got to make sure you fund all those things. Kurt, these are critical questions, and they're complicated questions. Thank you for simplifying for us.
Always a pleasure, Bruce. Thanks so much.
Kurt Rosentreter, CPA, portfolio manager with Manulife Securities, and we were talking about budgeting for the baby.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are a number of different kinds of rewards cards out there to help Canadians save money when they buy stuff. Which are the most popular, both in category and in brand? And how do you use them most effectively? Natasha McMillan is Director of Everyday Banking at RateHub.ca. She's also their resident credit card specialist. And she's here to talk about their top cards and how to use them in the best possible way. She's in Ottawa. Hello there.
Hi there.
So travel rewards cards are very popular, but what's their competition? Is it cashback cards? Is it gas rewards? What's the universe of options?
The biggest competition for travel credit cards is, as you mentioned, our cashback credit cards. Those have got great popularity, especially throughout the pandemic, as we saw people were traveling less. So there was a great pickup for those cards at that time.
There are a lot of people who are completely obsessed with this question. It's how you've created a business, because a lot of people are very involved in choosing the absolute, like, most important number one card in the world. How do you rank them? How do you rank these cards?
So we rank them based off of the types of where you can get your money from. So is it everyday typical purchases? Is it based off of just gas or groceries? And how many points you can get for your expenses. So some cards offer 2 times the points based on your purchase. Some of them offer only one type. So we're using that base to calculate the value that that card can bring to each consumer.
Now, your business model and that of any of these, you know, rate aggregators is to earn a small fee when someone applies for a credit card after visiting your site. How do you ensure that that business model doesn't affect your ranking? Because when I looked, all the cards at the top of the list were, quote, featured cards.
Yeah. So it's actually, we get, it's off of, based off of approval of the credit card. So what we're trying to ensure is that we're suggesting cards that work and fit the needs of our consumers. So we actually have online a flow that allows users to come on and put in exactly what they're looking for. I want a travel rewards credit card. I typically spend X. I'm also looking for a certain amount of perks, whether it's travel insurance or I want lounge access. And as they go through that flow, we actually run through our algorithm and suggest these would be the top cards. And so we provide options for that and they can kind of look through that and see what actually works to their benefit the best.
How do you ensure though that you're objective? Because if I was just running the P&L for RateHub, I would make darn sure that the cards that were at the top, that the algorithm put in front of a consumer were also ones that I made money from. And I can't imagine that you have an affiliate relationship on absolutely every single card in the Canadian marketplace.
Yeah, so that's a great question. A lot of what we're looking to do is to ensure that the customer experience is the best. So we're not only looking at where we make the most money, but actually cards that have the best benefit to our consumers and ensuring that they're getting the best bang for their buck. So what we don't want is to push forward, for example, a credit card that has no benefit to the users, because what will happen is they will come back, they'll post a negative review, and that will actually hurt our brand. So our main focus is ensuring that consumers are getting the best card for their use and ensuring that they know how to maximize the benefits that that card offers, and they are aware of the pitfalls as well.
And there's two parts to this equation here. Like, we want to earn the most points possible and we want to spend the points in the most efficient way. Let's talk about earning. What are the ways in which Canadians can use these cards to earn the absolute most number of points possible?
So it's really important to look at the fine details of each card. As I mentioned, some cards offer more points for restaurants and dining and groceries. Some cards offer points generically for any purchase made. So I think each user really has to look at their personal spending habits to identify what card will be the best for them.
One of the pitfalls that I've often pointed out is when people get so addicted to earning points, they make poor financial decisions because they're shopping for full priced stuff just because it's double or quadruple points day.
Exactly. One of the things that we highly recommend that people take advantage of as they're looking to maximize travel reward points is to look at these welcome bonuses. So you can quickly amass a ton of free points by taking advantage of these lucrative sign-up bonuses. So for example, right now, TD Aeroplan Visa Infinite is offering a welcome bonus. So if a user has identified the need for a travel credit card, it's beneficial to look at which ones are offering bonuses and which ones might be beneficial to them.
Spending is the other part of it here. I went on to spend some of my points on an airline. And then I thought, oh, well, while I'm here, I'll look at a rental car or a hotel. And the value of those rewards was a fraction of what I would have got dollar to dollar on a flight. What are some of the things that people should know about how those equations get calculated?
Yeah, so it's really important to note where you can get the benefit from. So for example, a lot of these credit cards offer renter car collision loss or damage. So it might actually be not beneficial to claim your points to book the rental car, but it's helpful to book the actual rental car with the credit card. And God forbid you get in an accident. So there are some of those benefits that it's always valuable to look at how you've earned your points and the value of those points when you look, go to redeem them.
So give me the insight here though, on my question. If I've got points that are way more, they go way further on a flight, does it follow that they go not as far on renting a car or booking a hotel room?
No, I wouldn't say there's necessarily a correlation with that. I think it really depends on each specific credit card and where their partnerships are. So for example, Aeroplan credit cards will give you a preferred booking with Air Canada. And so another example for that is the Brim MasterCard. You actually receive a discount on eligible airlines such as Lufthansa or Emirates. So it's really about looking at where you want to go and what the benefit you're looking to do and finding the right card to help you with that.
What caution would you offer consumers on credit card churn? Because some of these offers look amazing, but you and I both know that if people apply for a whole bunch of credit cards, if they cancel credit cards, there are very clear implications to their credit score.
Yeah, my advice would be to apply for a credit card that A, you will use, and not only just to maximize on the benefits. As you mentioned, canceling a credit card after a short period of time does hurt your credit score, or running a balance for a long period of time. So ensuring that you're using the point, you're using the benefits of the card without negatively impacting your credit score. So not making erroneous purchases just because there's a 4 times the points bonus for that month, but actually ensuring, do I need this? Is this fitting my lifestyle, and not going outside of your means in that sense?
Give me the top three credit cards that RateHub is putting forward at this moment in time, because I'm sure it's a competition that is fluid and there are winners, and you know the positioning of the top cards changes over time as different things happen. But what would you say by way of example on cards that top the list?
Some of the top cards that we're currently seeing right now are the TD Aeroplan Visa Infinite card. So some of the benefits there include a huge welcome bonus, and they're actually waiving the first year of annual fees. They have an Visa Infinite concierge service that's 24/7. So if you need some help with bookings, they're there to do that as well. This credit card also offers some great travel insurance. So for a weary traveler who perhaps is a little more uncomfortable and wants to ensure that they're covered, especially for COVID-19 related claims, this is a great card for that. Another credit card that we're also seeing is the American Express Cobalt. This card is great for groceries and restaurants. You actually earn 5 times the points for every dollar spent on groceries and restaurants. Similar to the TD Aeroplan Visa, they have insurance and some great travel medical insurance as well. If users are actually looking for a no annual fee credit card, the Brim MasterCard is a great one as a travel rewards card. Upon approval, you could immediately add the virtual Brim card to your mobile wallet and start using it right away. And as I mentioned, you also get 3% off on flights with eligible airlines such as Lufthansa and Emirates. And these three cards really offer a great variety of benefits for all different types of users.
Interesting. There is a lot of work for people to put into getting a great card. But from what you're saying, it sounds like it pays to become a temporary expert as you're making that decision. Natasha, thank you for your insight.
Thank you so much.
Natasha McMillan is Director of Everyday Banking at RateHub.ca. She was here to talk about the big card categories. Travel rewards cards, I think, are going to be picking up as people start leaving their houses again, as well as some pitfalls to be aware of as you look at the plastic in your wallet. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, I'll speak with Alyssa Davies, founder of Mixed Up Money. She's got a new book out called Financial First Aid, Essential Tools for Confident, Secure Money Management. And later, we're going to talk to a financial expert and planner, Stephen Brar, who is a model for financial planning that uses buckets. We're used to talking about spending in buckets, but not planning. So we'll make that the pivot with him. If you have missed an episode of Moolala on SiriusXM, very simple to go back and listen to our past episodes. You can do that in two ways. One is at moolala.ca, and you can search by name or topic. You can also go to the podcast platform. So we're on Spotify and Stitcher and Amazon Prime and Apple Music and all those. And you can download specific segments or the full show. And even better, subscribe so the next episode just shows up magically on your device.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. Planning for your financial future is really, really important, but no one owns a crystal ball. No one. I don't care who you are, you don't have one. And there are things that come up, some which we might have prepared for, emergencies that we might be able to predict, and some we never could have predicted. So how do you prepare for all of that? Alyssa Davies has written a book to get at some of these big questions. It is called Financial First Aid: Essential Tools for Confident, Secure Money Management. She joins us now from Calgary. Hello there.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I went through, first of all, even just the table of contents, and there are a lot of risks that you address here. Do you leave your house wrapped in bubble wrap from head to toe, wearing a helmet? Is this how you roll?
I should. I feel like at this point, because of my anxiety, I know exactly what could go wrong no matter where I go. But I've learned to look at that as a positive these days.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love that in one chapter you say, how many emergency funds should you have? 3? Whereas for someone who's been around as long as I have, I've been beating the emergency drum for years, but it's 1. It's like my standard is so much lower here. Why would someone need 3?
So I think for a lot of my readers, the constant back and forth between whether you need, like whether you can actually justify using your emergency fund, for one, because a lot of us have that fund and then we're scared to use it because it's been our security blanket for so long, or some of us have it and we just spend it willy-nilly on whatever we can because it exists and it's there in front of us and we have the money, so why not spend it? So I needed to find that balance between knowing what your emergency fund was for and when to use it. And that was when I started to compartmentalize my emergency funds into more specific accounts so that I felt comfortable using them. And I think a lot of people could benefit from that switch as opposed to just having that typical 3 to 6 months of expenses saved.
What are the different types?
So I have 3. I have one that's for me that protects me in my relationship because you never know what will happen in your romantic partnerships.
That's great.
I have one that protects my entire family. So if myself or my partner lost our job, we would have coverage. If there is a medical emergency that pushed one of us out of the workforce, we'd be covered. And then my last one is to protect our household, the 4 walls around us.
And what would go in? What would you, so 4 walls around you, would that be like the furnace broke down?
Yes. So that one is actually really interesting because a lot of us are always looking for that typical rule that we can use to apply to our emergency funds. Like how much specifically? I use a couple of different ways to save for my household emergency fund, which is I consider what my largest appliance is. So then I would just have that much money saved. That's an easy way to do it. But another thing to do is just to keep accumulating money every single month, whether it's $20 to $100. Because some years you're going to spend a lot of money upkeeping your home and other years you'll spend nothing.
Now, some of our listeners will be like, what is Alyssa smoking? She is clearly on a hallucinogen because in today's context, it's a miracle if I have like a dollar saved in an emergency fund, let alone 3. What do you say to those people?
I say that it doesn't matter how much is in the account. It's more about the emotional understanding or letting yourself wrap your mind around what the money is actually for. because money is heavily dictated by our emotions and how we feel. And if we can actually label things and give ourselves the awareness of what we're supposed to use it for and the why behind our money, it becomes a lot easier. So it's less about panicking over how much you have to save and more about discovering what you're actually saving for. Mm.
You write about how one can evaluate your safety net. And there are some, I think, more predictable ways that you would evaluate your safety net, and maybe some less predictable or less conventional ways. What are some of the less conventional things you would have us think about when we think about safety net?
I think a lot of us have shifted our mindset since the pandemic to consider more of those maybe not as obvious emergencies as more obvious these days. Things like climate change and natural disaster and how that's impacting our financial futures. And also things like financial abuse and maybe working in a toxic workplace and not feeling happy or confident in your relationship and feeling like you have no power. And that's a scary place to be. And so those are really practical things that we should be talking about more often, including also the conversation of what to do with your parents and their retirement and their inevitable, unfortunate death that we all are really uncomfortable talking about, but needs to be discussed.
I am a deluded optimist. So I wake up every day with, I hear the birds chirp and the bray of the unicorn and celebrate the rainbows that are coming across the sky. So I read these chapter headlines, I go through some of the content, and my temperament prevents me from thinking that this could ever happen, not even to anyone, or not even to me, but to anyone, right? You have a layer of lived experience that I don't, and a temperament that I don't, including a fire in your neighborhood. What did you learn from that?
Yes, there was a really unfortunate fire, something that happens thousands of times every single year in Canada. It's not something you ever want to imagine happening. It's not something anyone should ever have to experience, but it is a reality that can happen. And as soon as I saw that in the news and heard from my neighbors and other community members, it really clicked into me that I needed to take our kind of emergency planning at home a lot more seriously. And that in a way is also really connected to money, because what happens when something like that happens, a natural disaster or a preventable home maintenance issue that you maybe aren't going to experience in your lifetime, but should still have a plan for? Mm.
I want to ask you just before we go here, as you know, my day job is with Credit Canada, and I want your take on the question of when someone should be considering debt consolidation, a bankruptcy filing, a consumer proposal filing. What are some things you would have people think about on that front?
Yes. I think, first of all, I always like to say that we are inept to feeling this extreme amount of shame and guilt when we're not doing everything right with our money. But we always forget that no one else is doing everything right. We're all making mistakes. And that is very much the case when it comes to debt. And when you're dealing with something like debt consolidation or bankruptcy, those places exist for a reason. And if you're dealing with mass amounts of stress to the point where you cannot sleep at night, you cannot make the minimum payments on your credit card, you are getting collections agencies calling you daily, then it's time and it's perfectly okay to ask for help and to speak with a professional, because they are going to be able to negotiate on your behalf if you're not comfortable with that, or at the very least, offer you with some sort of plan with some tangible steps to take to give yourself a fighting chance.
Alyssa, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Alyssa Davies is the author of Financial First Aid, Essential Tools for Confident, Secure Money Management. She was in Calgary, Alberta.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to financial expert and planner Stephen Brar about segmenting your financial planning into buckets. But first, Kelly Lavallee, CPA and certified divorce financial analyst, is going to talk about her book, Untying the Knot, Protecting Your Emotional and Financial Health During Divorce. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, very simple to do so. We have a newsletter that comes out just once a month. You can sign up for that newsletter on moolala.ca and you'll receive it. It has links to what we've been doing on SiriusXM and CBC Radio and CityLine and Vienna Bloomberg and all that stuff.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Going through a divorce can have so many challenges. It is emotionally stressful and it can take a big toll on your finances, something that we've talked about many times on this program before. There is a new book to look at some of the things that you can do to prepare yourself financially for some of the hurdles that you're going to have to leap over along the way. Kelly Lavallee is a CPA, certified divorce financial analyst, and she has written a book called Untying the Knot, Protecting Your Emotional and Financial Health During Divorce. She joins us today from Vancouver. Hello.
Hello.
A certified divorce financial analyst? Did you just make that up or is that a thing?
Of course it's a thing.
Oh my gosh. How does one earn the thing? How do you get one of those?
Everyone wants one.
Totally. What does it mean to be a certified divorce financial analyst?
I mean, part of it is some additional technical learning. It is a technical process. And I mean, I think one of the things it tells you if you're considering engaging someone to help you out with the divorce is it's a sign that someone's chosen to specialize in this fabulous area.
You have credentials, but you also have lived experience. So you have been through a divorce of your own marriage. You were a child of parents who divorced. How would you say that affected you and your outlook on this topic? And I'm especially interested in the answer because I too am a child of parents who were divorced in the late 70s.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we had a front row seat to our parents' divorce. And back then, there wasn't a ton of support. And I think maybe as a result of that, things often didn't go all that well, particularly in my situation financially. There's a lot of conflict between my parents. And I think it's part of the reason that people are very motivated to do it differently now. And I want to be part of that. Like, let's change this up. Let's make this a little bit better.
How was your experience when you walked this path yourself?
You know, I was young. And so, I mean, it was a lot simpler than it might have been considering we didn't have much or make much or have kids. But I'll also share with you that in my second marriage, in which I do have kids and I'm a stepmom and we were, you know, further along financially, my husband and I separated for a year and went through the financial negotiation. So I have way too much experience.
Well, I don't think way too much. I can imagine it's deeply comforting to clients who come to you and know viscerally that you get their experience because you've walked it twice in different ways, but walked it twice. I want to get into the book and in particular, talk about something you call divorce limbo. What does that mean? And how does that affect, what are the financial dynamics of that? Because I'm sure there's all sorts of emotional dynamics that go with divorce limbo. What are the financial dynamics?
Yeah, I mean, this is just a phrase that I've coined for that time between when you separate and when you have your final settlement done. And so this is such an uncertain time. And I think if you haven't been through it, you might imagine divorce as a line. You step over it, right? You're married now you're divorced, but it's actually a life stage. And for a lot of people, it's a long time. And the unraveling of every area of your life, and my particular interest being the finances, it takes time. And there are some particular risks associated with the fact that you're still in entangled and meshed with one another financially, but your interests are no longer aligned through marriage. So this can create some particular challenges that I think, you know, often even us professionals who are in the business of divorce, we really want to help our clients get to the end. And people who are in it really want to get to the end. So you often have your eye on, let's sort out our final settlement. But the first step is to make sure that you're as safe and secure as possible for this period while you're sorting things out.
Financial homework is key. What does that entail? And in particular, I want to know what that entails in which there is a significant income disparity or perceived or actual power disparity.
For sure. I mean, you would think that gathering the financial information would be the easy part, but actually it's really tough. I think one of the reasons is it's what you do first. Everyone is very raw. But, you know, finances is one of those areas where we often divide and conquer in marriage, right? Like, it's one of the good things about me and being married, you can focus on your strengths. So often you're going in to a divorcing situation where one person has way more information and experience and comfort dealing with the finances. So the first step is, in particular, if you're the person that wasn't as focused on the family finances, is to gain an understanding. This sounds simple, but to gain an understanding of what you own and owe and what you make and spend. You know, of course, us accountants would like you to do that even when you're married, but it's vital early days just to get an understanding of what's our current lay of the land financially.
There is a negotiating phase, increasingly or more complicated when kids are involved, because there's a whole bunch of stuff on that front. But let's try and keep it to the financial lane. What advice do you have for parties on this phase? And I would ask this question of a lawyer, but because anytime they extend the phase, it's costing a lot more money. You go to court, it's costing you a gazillion dollars more than if you can settle it amiably without all of those interventions. But from a financial perspective, what would you say about the negotiating process?
I think first you hit the nail on the head, which is to understand that it is a negotiation. I mean, that can be uncomfortable. I think initially you might hope that it didn't have to feel like a business deal because you're still connected to this person, or you might be on the other end of the spectrum thinking it's going to be a fight. So I think the first step is just to hopefully embrace the idea that it is a negotiation. And so, like any negotiation, you know, you have to hopefully get your head around the idea that you will not get everything that you want, and your counterparty, that sounds a little cold because we're talking about someone you're married to, but they're not going to get everything that they want either. So, you know, I hopefully can just get in the mindset of some give and take and being flexible. Again, when you're going through this personal trauma, you're not feeling very flexible because there's so much change going on in your life. And when you're going through this negotiation, every decision you're making is capturing more change. You're going to be giving up some of your asset base and deciding what to do.
And certainly the context for the discussion can be, it was your decision, it was my decision, or we came to this decision together. But how you arrive to the point where you're in a office negotiating this can include the circumstances at which you find yourself there.
Absolutely. I think if you could do one thing, it would be to shift your perspective from looking back at the marriage and playing out whatever dynamic was happening, especially at the end, because that's often not that great, to looking forward. This negotiation is about what your life is going to look like after. And that will kind of help you hopefully think a little bit more clearly, because what we're trying to do in the negotiation is be as pragmatic as possible, because you're going to end up having a quicker, cheaper, and better outcome.
The finish line. At some point, there will be a finish line. It is in all likelihood a marathon, but whether it's a marathon that's 26.2 miles or 187.3 thousand miles, there is some ways that the soon to be former couples can influence that. How do you set realistic expectations on timing and realistic expectation on what the air quotes finish line actually looks like?
Timing, and anyone who's gone through it will probably be feeling this viscerally, it takes way, way longer than you would hope. And so what I do encourage people to do is, instead of looking at the finish line, like holding your breath until you get there, look at the next step or two, and make sure that you're not extremely uncomfortable while you're, you know, working towards that finish line. The other thing that I prepare my clients for is, especially when you're in it, you imagine, when I get to the finish line, I'm going to be so thrilled that this is over. But in my experience, when you get there, most people, the last thing they feel is thrilled. And it isn't necessarily because they've struck a bad deal at all. It's just that, you know, when, well, of course, when you got married, this was not the end that you imagined or hoped for. And divorcing, okay, it sucks, but it's got some energy to it. And it was perhaps the energy that was sustaining you through this really terrible time. And when you reach your final settlement, that energy is gone. So just like any, when any big project is over and we feel kind of deflated, this is sort of like the mother of all projects, and it leaves you feeling deflated.
It's a really, that's a really insightful observation there. I do want to give you one last word, and that is, what is hopeful about embarking on the process that you outline in the book here? What difference can it make for readers in coming to a conclusion in which they do the best they can from an emotional and financial perspective in terms of health?
When you're in it, it's hard to see that there's anything good.
Yeah. So what, I mean, you've walked this path many, many times as an observer. You've walked it personally, but as an observer, and I want to finish with a note of hope.
I will tell you what I've observed and been totally inspired by, through, you know, despite the hardship of my practice, is I see people come into their own and gain the confidence that they can do it. I know they could do it right from the beginning, but when you start out and you're feeling overwhelmed and scared, and mainly what you're feeling is loss, you're not feeling your most confident. And so, the hope that I want to give to people is, you will move through that. You'll gain, you'll just essentially take the power back that potentially you handed some over to your mate during your marriage, and certainly felt sapped of during your divorce.
Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly LaValle is a CPA, certified divorce financial analyst, and the author of Untying the Knot, Protecting Your Emotional and Financial Health During Divorce. Stay with us. Coming up next, segmenting your financial plan into buckets. Buckets. Hopefully they're not leaky buckets. Buckets. Financial planner, financial expert Stephen Brar will be here. And just a note here, if you have thoughts, if you have ideas, if you have feedback, if you have questions, very, very simple to send us all that. ask@moolala.ca is our email address. Moolala is sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Yes, yes, yes. You need to set goals. You need to create a plan. All of those things are important as you think about a financial plan. One way to go about this is to segment your planning into buckets. And what I find interesting about this is we talk a lot about putting spending into buckets, but we don't talk about putting financial planning into buckets. So we're going to talk about this method with financial expert and planner, Stephen Brar. He's with GNF Financial Group, and he is in Abbotsford, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
I'm great. Where did this particular approach come from? Were you, I don't know, did you have a leaky ceiling and you put a bucket under there and then you thought, wait a second?
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to that. I mean, a lot of us at different stages in our life, we do have a leaky ceiling. You know, if we're in our early 20s, maybe the leaky ceiling might have been just cash flow management. You know, we're just spending too much. We're just, you know, ordering too much online or just not saving enough. So, you know, we're all at different stages in our lives. And, you know, that's where these segments come in. So they are part of an overall financial plan, but they're almost like mini plans within the general financial plan. So they really kind of bring it all together.
Mm. Can you give us some examples of what you mean?
Yeah.
What are the buckets called?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'll just give my own example. When I was in my mid-20s, newly married, mortgage, young daughter, one of three that I have now. But at that time, I mean, it was really about, you know, going out there, earning money to pay the mortgage, pay the, you know, the schooling and all that kind of stuff. While my wife, God bless her, you know, was at home looking after the kids. One of the segments was just the foundation of having life insurance in place, just some cheap term life insurance in place. So if Stephen, you know, God forbid, kicked the bucket, I mean, there's going to be some money there to pay off the debts, raise the kids. So that was a really important bucket or segment in my overall financial plan. There were other parts to it as well, you know, debt reduction, saving for retirement, but that was a really important one. That was, you know, something on my mind. So that's something that that's an example of having a bucket within the general financial plan.
How do you, in your work, prioritize these buckets for individuals? I mean, sure, it would be delightful if every single area was covered off and buttoned down, but that's just not realistic for most people. They have to set priorities. How would you help them do that?
And again, excellent question. So what we would do, Bruce, is, you know, we just meet the person and really get to know where they're at today in their life journey. You know, what stage are they at? You know, are they at the, you know, the early stages, you know, the accumulation stage? Are they, you know, closer to retirement where they're really looking to pull the trigger and, you know, hang up their shingle? So it's really about having that conversation about where they're at in their life journey, their stage in life. And then just understanding their goals, you know, whether they're, you know, the goal is to purchase a property, get into the real estate market or retirement goals. So that's where we really start. It's about having those conversations and just doing a really good discovery. In fact, you know, my whole approach is I'm just a little bit nosy, you know, that's where I really get that information, get them to really talk. And everybody's at, you know, at different stages, especially these days, it's all over the
place. One of the pitfalls of the way the financial services industry is structured in that traditional financial advisors are paid on investments, principally. Like that's the big, even if it could be, fee-based, it could be commission-based, but that's where the comp is. How do you include the liability side of the balance sheet, the debt planning that should be a part of that overall conversation, even if an advisor isn't compensated on that?
So again, the financial plan, the comprehensive financial plan would encompass, you know, debt management, you know, whether it's the, you know, debt consolidation, just having a conversation around debt. And that's just one part of the plan. So, you know, the part where, you know, most advisors would get compensated would be the investment part of it, you know, whether they're collecting a fee, whether they're collecting an embedded commission. But the financial plan, you know, encompasses a lot more than just the investments. There's a tax segment, there's a real estate segment, there's the debt management segment, the cash flow segment, retirement income planning segment. So just a lot more to it. And with us at GNF, the financial plan for our members, our clients, is included as part of the service that we offer.
You are not a gambler when it comes to investing, as I understand it. I think your phrase is investing should be like watching grass grow. Why do you approach it in that way?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I always have. I have my so-called heroes, people that I've followed over decades. I've been in the business for 20 plus years, but investing, for over 30 years. And so, yeah, my favorite quote is, it's in my office, from Paul Samuelson, the Nobel Prize winning economist. Investing should be more like watching the paint dry or watching grass grow. If you want excitement, take $800 and go to Vegas. And really, it's, just watching Buffett and Munger this weekend, and just the simplicity of actual investing. It's not complicated. It's actually very simple. Our industry likes to make it more complicated, make it more, I think, confusing for people, but it's really, really simple, especially the investment part of it. I think that's the simplest part. You have some proper asset allocations, proper diversification. Understand the person that you're dealing with. Are they risk takers? Are they speculators? Are they gamblers? Are they just, common folk who just want a decent risk-adjusted rate of return so they can have, a decent retirement? And that's kind of what we look at. We kind of don't speculate, don't chase, don't kind of ignore the markets, Bruce, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. I've been singing that song for a long time. Just before we go here, what I love is the power of thinking about these things in a discrete way. So they fit in a bucket, because that gives you, it's less overwhelming if you focus on the bucket. And at the same time, paradoxically, all of those buckets interact. In fact, you could take everything in the bucket and throw it in a bathtub, because the debt plan is inextricably linked to the risk plan, which is inextricably linked to the investing, all those things. What would you say about the process by which you need to bring it all together?
It's just having a comprehensive financial plan, that just looks at all the different segments of our lives, like the investments, the real estate, the pensions, cash flow, debt, taxes, estate planning, et cetera, and just look at the whole picture rather than just the, the short-term fluctuations in our investments. So even though our emotions, they can get the best of us in volatile times like we're having today, the actual facts in the financial plan, the actual facts within the financial plan in those buckets, they're saying a different thing. They're telling us that, we're actually okay. We're actually on track, even though it looks like the sky is falling. So that's really how I bring it together. The financial plan is just a reminder that our financial lives, they're made up of much more than just the fluctuating monthly returns on our stocks or our ETFs or our mutual funds. And then having that properly segmented financial plan, in place, it just reduces that financial anxiety and stress. Does that make sense?
100%. I'm more chill just having had this conversation. I never chill. More chill. Stephen, thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me, Bruce.
Stephen Brar, GNF Financial Group. He joined us to talk about the bucket approach to thinking about all the things you need to do and focus on when it comes to your money. Well, that's our show for today. So a thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and to Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. To stay updated on all things Moolala, it's simple to do that. You can subscribe to our newsletter. You can do that by going to moolala.ca. And you can also subscribe to the podcast version of this show wherever you get your podcasts. Follow me on social media. I'm at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.